Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, the show that aims to get you thinking and listen to around the world via our podcast. You can find it at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And great to bring you a biblically focused edition of the show today with a number of Christian guests. Actually, we're dispensing with our usual Christian non-Christian format today to hear from a variety of views on the historical Jesus. I'll be introducing them in a little bit, and loads of feedback as well on the end of today's show. Huge mailbag of feedback that I've received over the Christmas and New Year period. We'll try and get to as much of that as possible. Great to have you with me here on the program. And just a reminder that the Unbelievable Conference is coming Saturday the 9th of May, and we are going to be opening up the ticketing website this coming week. So look out for it at unbelievable.live. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll remember that that's where you could get details of our last conference in the USA. Well, we're going to be updating it in the coming week to give you details of the UK conference, our London conference, Saturday the 9th of May. If you go there at the time of recording, it won't be ready, but it will be ready by about midweek. So looking forward to releasing details of that. Very excited, of course, that we've got N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, joining us for the day. And I'm going to be releasing details later in the week of the other guests, and one who had just confirmed very recently, who I'm really excited about, especially to have him with Tom Wright. I'm going to keep it a secret till next week, but I know a lot of people are going to be excited about who we've got lined up in addition to N.T. Wright for this year's conference. So I'll spill the beans on next week's show and probably on social media when we release the ticketing details this coming week. But do ring fence that date and make sure you get booked in when the ticketing goes live at unbelievable.live. It's happening Saturday the 9th of May. As I say, lots of response coming later on in the show to some of those great programmes we've been able to air recently. Douglas Murray and Esther O'Reilly. And of course, last week's big conversation between Matt Dillahunty and Glenn Scrivener. Great to see all of the different responses that have been coming in. And I told you at the beginning of the year that in the early part of 2020, we're going to be trying out some different music on Unbelievable. So as I introduce today's show, tell me what you think of this one.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'm joined by three Christians on today's show with different perspectives on issues around Jesus studies and the historicity of the Gospels. We're going to be hearing from John Dixon, firstly. Great new book out on Is Jesus History? He's an Australian Bible scholar. I'll be introducing John in just a moment's time. Later on in the show, I'm going to be joined by Lydia McGrew and Jonathan McClatchy. Lydia's new book, The Mirror and the Mask, is highly critical of some trends in evangelical scholarship, which she believes are downplaying the reliability of the gospel texts. So you'll be hearing from Lydia and Jonathan later on in the show. Great pleasure to be joined in studio now by John Dixon, who is a Bible scholar. He's the founding director of the Australian Centre for Public Christianity. I think teaches Origins of Christianity as well at the University of Sydney. Is that correct, John? There are many other titles I could give you, but perhaps most importantly, and the reason you're in the show today, is Jesus History, your new book, published by the Good Book Company. It's a relatively small volume as well, but it's packed with great stuff. So welcome back to the show.
Thank you,
John.
Great to talk with you. The reason I'm here is because you invited me.
Well,
and
absolutely.
I love chatting with you.
Well, I'm glad you're
we
here.
We could leave the book aside as far as I'm concerned.
We've already had a great chat even before we started recording, actually. So much stuff I want to cover in this little interview now. It was about a year ago we last caught up and we did an edition of the Profile podcast.
I think I overshared. I think that was the verdict of some of my friends.
I somehow managed to get some really interesting little things out of you, yeah, on that one.
I'm prepared now.
Well,
I have
yes,
my armor.
He knows what I'm like. No, it was fascinating actually because we got your background as a, you know, your time in a rock band, all the kind of interesting facets of your life. If you want the full story, do go back to January 2018 in the Profile podcast, and you'll be able to hear more details about John's life.
But, or not.
He doesn't want you to. It's the quickest way to make someone go and listen to something. Tell us about Is Jesus History? I mean, you've written a number of books on the historical Jesus. What's this one particularly? I like the fact as well, it's got obviously a double meaning in the title too.
Sure. So it is addressing the historical question, but it's also asking the question, is it just history and we don't have to worry about it? But it seems to me there are loads of books trying to prove everything in the Jesus story, down to the details. And there are loads of books that are trying to debunk the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't much that just sort of sails happily down the middle, asking what would we know about Jesus if we just approached it not in a kind of skeptical or overly theological way, but as an ancient historian studies Alexander the Great or Emperor Tiberius or anyone like that. So this is what it's trying to do, but for a general public who hasn't, you know, been to the classics department, but wants to know how classicists and ancient historians just try and assess the general plausibility of their ancient figures and events. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. And you've got a number of different, obviously, chapters and sections of the book. I think one of the key things that you major on and has been part of your own, obviously, academic work is oral tradition. And I'd like to talk about that in the course of this interview. But first of all, one of the funniest things in the book was the Eat My Bible challenge that you issued on Twitter a little while ago. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I tweeted and then in a rush of blood to the head even wrote an article for our national broadcaster in Australia saying, look, I will eat a page of my Bible if you can find just one professor of ancient history, classics or New Testament in any university in the world who argues Jesus didn't live. So there are thousands of such professors, and I make clear, I mean a real professor in the British and Australian sense, not just someone who's taught in a university once. And when it went onto the Twitter sphere, I had a lot of skeptical friends and, you know, not so friends say, oh, we're going to make you eat your whole Bible, stand by. And I, you know, I thought, what have I done? And they started to cite professors of English literature, philosophy, psychology. There was one professor of poetry cited, a famous professor of German language, G.A. Wells, the same.
Who was cited by Dawkins, I think, in The God Delusion.
Famously, Richard Dawkins says a serious historical case can be made that Jesus never lived at all, as has been made by G.A. Wells.
I think he's slightly backtracked on that in his latest book, the Outgrowing God book, though he's still very sceptical, obviously.
Yes, but I, you know, when the 10th anniversary edition of The God Delusion came out, I got it.
Yeah.
I went and bought my second copy and turned to that page and it's still there.
Right.
Okay. So he had a chance to, because lots of people picked him up on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
All he had to do is walk down to the classics department at Oxford, right? It's just down the road from where he is.
Yeah.
And ask anyone there. And they would have said, no.
Anyway, the point is, Lots of people were put forward
yes.
In an attempt to make you eat your Bible,
yes.
but none of them qualified as far as you're concerned.
Well, I mean, in terms of the challenge, a professor of classics or ancient history or New Testament in a university. No one has been put forward. I've heard that there's an atheist group in Sydney that's still looking. And, you know, when they find one, they're apparently going to come and try and, you know, interview me and make me eat my a part of my Bible. So I'm already prepared. I'm going to eat Matthew chapter 1.
Right.
Chop it up into little bits. Put it on Vegemite toast so no one can taste it. And I'll probably make a little speech to camera that goes something like, well, it's 5 years and you found one.
Right. Well, and the point of all this being that despite the fact there is, you know, if you went simply online, did a Google search for does Jesus exist, you might be thinking, oh, this is a live debate, you know, so many websites out there claiming he didn't and so on. But the reality is in the academic world, it simply isn't really a debate that anyone's having.
It doesn't register. I mean, there are some grown-up books trying to argue it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be completely dismissive, but the thing is, you just have to go to the compendiums of ancient historical knowledge, like the Oxford Classical Dictionary, or the Cambridge Ancient History, or the big German Ancient History volume, Brill's New Pauli, and just go to the section on Jesus and Christianity and see if any doubt whatsoever is raised. And they all talk about Jesus and talk about what historians know about Jesus. And it's really a given that he genuinely lived. He was a teacher, he was a healer, and he was crucified by Pontius Pilate.
Okay. You tell the story of a student you once had who turned into a Jesus existence denier. In fact, I have tried to invite that particular person who's now, I think, published a book or two on the subject, Raphael Latasta, on the show. Interestingly, when I offered him, not for you, but for a different person to come on, he said, no, I don't debate Christians on the historical Jesus. And he said, because there are so many assumptions Christians are making, I'll only debate a secular historian, which I was quite surprised by. What do you make of that?
I don't know. I mean, when he was sat in my class, he was a pretty lovely guy and he asked questions and obviously was skeptical about stuff, but he seemed perfectly reasonable. But I think he's gone on to trade in this hyper-skeptical religious discussion, which is the mirror image of the fundamentalist Christian apologetics, which try to overprove things.
Right. Yeah.
There's this
extremes
mob
on both sides.
And they're basically just throwing hand grenades at each other.
I mean, the invitation still stands, Raphael, if you're listening. But this is a show where, you know, when we do the discussion format, we do have Christians and non-Christians. So I'm interested in obviously bringing that. But I think the underlying assumption often made by skeptics is, well, if you're a Christian, you're sort of committed, come what may, to so you're kind of not doing history at that point because you've got this bias for it all to be true. So even the best Christian historians are still doing apologetics at some level. What's your response to that?
Well, but then you would have to say you can't believe an atheist on the same topic too,
because they've got an assumption. Yeah, sure.
Can't believe an atheist on cosmology that tries to say there's no God. Well, because an atheist would obviously think there's no God. I just think that's so childish that the grown-up way to approach this is to say, let's see what the rules of mainstream history are and see if we can't agree on the rules and then make an argument based on the rules.
Now, tell me what you're wearing around your neck right now, John, because this comes up in the book.
I mean, for 20 years, I've worn a silver denarius.
And I can see it right now. You're like one of those medallion men, but it's you haven't got the hairy chest, and it's only a very small medallion.
Yes. lots of people have come up in the past and said, oh, is that a St. Christopher or something? No, it's the pagan Emperor Tiberius.
Why wouldn't you? I mean, come on.
So, I mean, I've collected coins for years, and of course it's the coin, or I'll say coinage, not coin, that Jesus was asked about when they said, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And he said, whose image is it? And they said, Caesar's. And he said, well, you give to Caesar what is Caesar's and pay to God what is God's. And it's described as a silver denarius, and the emperor of the time was Tiberius. So it could have been this coin.
It could have
more
been
likely
the very
this
coin
than the one in your pocket, Justin.
Wow. That would be something, wouldn't it?
But so I often
if you're
take
actually
this,
wearing a coin that Jesus had handled.
Indeed. I mean, it's a 2,000-year-old thing. And I often, I mean, the main reason I wear it is not just because it's that coin in the Gospels.
Yeah.
Because it just makes me remember, if I'd forgotten, that the past was once just as solid as this piece of silver around my neck. I mean, people really lived. This was not Middle Earth, but the Middle East. So someone got this at the end of a hard day's work. They bought goblets of wine with it. They probably got up to all sorts of sordid things with it.
Yeah.
And then some poor mug lost it, only to be found.
There'd be a fascinating novel in there, tracing the journey of a denarius in the Middle East in the first century, wouldn't there?
Yeah, it would be.
And the point of that is, yes, history is something that really happened. Obviously, at 2,000 removes from the first century, we've obviously only got bits and pieces, whatever survived, essentially, down to us today. And that's the problem that I encounter with a lot of skeptics who will simply say, well, fine, something happened. Maybe there was a guy called Jesus traveling around preaching, but we've got so little evidence now, 2,000 years later, that you can't possibly make these grand claims about him being the Son of God and rising from the dead and everything else. So where do you begin as a historian with that?
Well, there's a basic principle at play that, sure, maybe less than 1% of things have survived, 1% of buildings, 1% of inscriptions, 1% of documents. But from that 1%, you can positively affirm a whole bunch of things. The problem is you can't disconfirm based on the missing 99%. So, I mean, just a random example that I was teaching recently to a class. We have this amazing letter from June 1 BC, where a Roman soldier in Alexandria writes to his wife, Alice, and says, "I'm going to send my pay soon. Hang on. And by the way, Aphrodisius asked me if I'm forgetting you. How could I forget you, my darling?"
Aw.
Ah, lovely. Now, we found that in a rubbish tip.
Yeah.
It's part of the Oxyrhynchus papyri. And so suddenly, you know, this couple that we knew nothing about, this one positive piece of evidence tells us there really was a man called Hilarion. He was married to Alice. He was a Roman soldier stationed in Alexandria. We know from that letter that Roman soldiers were paid and were allowed to transport their pay to different areas. There's tons you can positively affirm.
None of which they realized they were providing historians 2,000 years later.
But. Exactly. we have over 100 letters from Pliny, the governor at the beginning of the 2nd century. And from those letters, we can tell an awful lot about sport and politics and architecture and hunting. He sort of liked hunting, but would often take his stylus and notepad to doodle and make notes while he waited for the boar to go past. And we can positively affirm tons of things, but we can't therefore deny stuff about the emperor or the governor down the road who didn't write letters, or at least whose letters we don't have. A classic example would be there was this skeptical article in the Australian Rationalist some years ago saying, if Jesus really existed, why isn't he mentioned in the letters of Governor Pilate back to Tiberius? Huh?
Right.
We don't have a single letter from Pontius Pilate to Tiberius about anything through the whole of his 10 years tenure.
Some kind of small town provincial preacher who got, you know, crucified along with literally thousands of other people every year.
So absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. But the evidence that does remain tells you positively loads of stuff. Mm. If 1% of Premier Radio documents and devices survived 2,000 years, we could affirm loads of things about what happened here.
I remember when I had Mark Goodacre on the show, this is going back several years now, he debated Richard Carrier on the existence of Jesus. Richard Carrier is a well-known mythicist. And the thing that stuck in my mind that Mark Goodacre said, it's actually almost a miracle, in his view, how much we have about Jesus, given how minimal the recording was of any significant person at that time. I mean, only the most famous, most rich people really got their histories recorded in the first century. So having anything at all, let alone four accounts and Paul's letters and even mentions in, you know, extra biblical sources and everything, is something of a miracle, even though, you know, the skeptics will say, well, it's still not enough.
Well, Professor Alana Nobbs, who's was the head of the ancient history department at Macquarie University, a famous Roman historian, has said the same thing. It's astonishing how much we have for Jesus. And the other curious thing is our materials are a rare example of history from below. I was talking to Teresa Morgan from Oxford, who's in the classics department there. And one of the things she said she loves about the New Testament, aside from anything religious, is that it's one of the few bodies of documents from people who were non-elites. I mean, sure, we have scraps of, you know, a one paragraph letter from Hilarion to his wife, Alice, a soldier.
Yeah.
But we don't have a body of information from that class.
Mm.
But she said these people were clearly non-elites. And in that first two or three centuries, it was clearly copied by non-elites. Because you look at our copies of the New Testament from that early few centuries.
Mm.
They're non-elite scribes that are copying this stuff. Only in the 4th and 5th century do you start to get beautiful scribal stuff.
Right.
So our New Testament documents, it's not only great that we have them, it's wonderful that they're not from the powerful. It's not part of a movement that's trying to force itself on others. It's a movement from below.
Mm. Nonetheless, again, I'm playing the skeptic here. A lot of the skeptics I meet say, but you know, when you come to something like the Gospels, they had an agenda. They were written by people trying to persuade other people. So we can't treat them as kind of neutral historical objects.
Oh,
they
of course
they,
not.
They have you know, they're there to, you know, so it's Christian propaganda, essentially, and they're going to inevitably paint Jesus as much more than he ever was historically and all the rest of it. So how do you deal with that kind of criticism?
Well, it's pejorative to say it's propaganda, but it's true to say they have a perspective that colours everything. But someone who's used to dealing with ancient material just doesn't see that as any problem, because Josephus has a bias, we could say, or a perspective. In fact, he has a double bias. He's pro-Roman and he's pro-Jewish, and he's trying to walk a very funny line there. And we can see that play out in the way he tells stories. That kind of bias rarely invents things out of whole cloth. It colours things, for sure. The same is true of Tacitus, the greatest of all our Roman chroniclers from the ancient world, loved one version of the Roman way, particularly Augustus, and hated another version, Nero.
Right.
That colours the way he tells the story.
Mm.
But he's telling a genuine story. It's just that you can see Tacitus in it as well.
Mm.
And I would say it is no different. Historians read the Gospels just like that. Of course, they don't privilege the Gospels like a Christian does, you know, as the holy word of God. But nor do they come to it with skeptical prejudice the way some of our skeptical friends do. They just say it's a human text with a perspective. Now let's read it and study it and see if it fits with what we know of Judea and Galilee in the first century.
So the book is called Is Jesus History? And it, as I say, it's remarkably short given the amount of area you cover in it. And one of the most significant things, I think, you know, one fascinating part of it for me was what you talk about oral tradition. And now this has become quite an interesting live subject recently. We had one of our big conversation episodes here on Unbelievable was between Bart Ehrman, well known as a sort of quite skeptical New Testament scholar, well respected, but skeptical of the reliability of aspects of the New Testament, and Peter J. Williams, who takes a much more, if you like, confident approach to the reliability of the Gospels. And one thing that came up among many was oral tradition. That is, before the Gospels were written down, how much did the stories change because of the fact that they were being passed from person to person and were being remembered, essentially, and then before they actually got formally written down? Now, there was an interesting sort of exchange where Peter J. Williams had made the point, as he makes in his book, Can We Trust the Gospels, that there's an awful lot that the writers get right historically. You can see that they're getting names and places and cultural aspects correct. So they seem to get a lot of the detail right. And he said that should give us confidence that they got the story right of Jesus, that they're faithfully passing on what he said and did and so on. And Bart said, I could grant you all that. You know, I don't really have an art. I could probably agree with all of these historical details, but they can still get the story wrong. And he said, oral studies in oral tradition show that that does happen. People get the details right, but get the story wrong. And he gave a kind of example of, you know, say I had been traveling to London and I could, you know, historians dug up a story about it where all the details are right about the stations I passed through and the places I went and so on. But then I invented some story about there being an explosion and I never made it to the interview. And that was interesting to me. I hadn't heard that before, that this is the way oral tradition operates. What's your response to that? Because you've done a lot of study in oral tradition yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, and it's my principal research project at the moment. Well, I haven't heard the interview, so okay. I can't comment on the nuances, but it sounds to me like the opposite of where I think oral tradition studies and the study of memory in modern psychological studies has been going for years. It's more common to find people saying that the gist and thrust and core and vibe of an event is the most easily fixed and the most secure, securely fixed in the mind. And it's the details that can flop around.
Right.
And so there's plenty of work on this. There's an Oxford University Press book called Memory and Emotion that's worth looking at that does the modern psychological studies. But one really important writer who's no friend of Christian apologetics is Dale Allison, really important leader in historical Jesus studies over many decades. And this is one of the things he's really brought to historical Jesus studies recently, that memory studies show that the core is preserved with great stability and the details can flip-flop around. And from that, he offers this criterion of recurring motif. He says that what we should be looking for in the Gospels and other materials is not Jesus saying exactly the same thing in every source, but if you can find a recurring motif across sources, mm-hmm. that's the sort of thing that our old tradition will remember. So don't worry about the precise words. Look for the themes. I think that's a very responsible way to work the history. My own research, though, is actually looking at how the ancients preserved things in detail. Because it's one thing to rely on modern memories in our memory atrophy culture,
yeah,
where I can't even remember my friends' phone numbers.
Because they're all there on our phone. We've got email. We've got so many ways in which we don't no longer have to store anything in our heads because it's stored on Wikipedia or somewhere else.
The ancients thought that the memory was one of the principal intellectual organs.
Right.
And they trained the memory, no matter what class you came from childhood. So we know that a 10-year-old in school, in little Greek school, had to memorize definitions of things and then be drilled like a catechism according to the definition. We have examples of this.
Mm.
We know that if you wanted to get into the Epicurean school, which is a wildly popular school in Paul's day, if you just wanted to get in, you had to remember 2,000 words, that is 40 paragraphs of Epicurus's what's called the Curiae Doxae, right. The authoritative sayings. And that's a 40-paragraph summary of what Epicurus taught. Just to begin. Now, these are not elites, because Epicurus was doggedly egalitarian, a bit like the church, actually. He said the less Greek education you've had, the better off you'll be in his school. So it was open to women and slaves and so on. And they all had to remember these 40 paragraphs. And those 40 paragraphs are themselves a summary of the whole system. But those 40 paragraphs are then summarized into a little creed, it was called the Tetrapharmakos, that was like a little jingle that Epicureans would say,
right.
Which was a summary of a summary of the summary. Now, what I'm particularly looking at the moment is how you've got exactly the same thing in the New Testament.
Right.
New Testament scholars call them creeds. There are about 12 examples in the New Testament. But I'm actually trying to show, I think the evidence is pretty clear, that these tiny little jingles or summaries are deliberate epitomes of much larger content, which was also memorized, because that is how you memorize stuff in high school, in school, in primary school, in philosophical clubs, in the Jewish synagogue, and it really looks like the early church from the very beginning committed stuff to memory.
I mean, the example that's popping into my head is 1 Corinthians 15 and Paul's institution of the Lord's Supper and his death and so on. That for you strikes you as that kind of
Well, that's example. There are two remarkable examples right there. There's the full-blown memory of on the night he was betrayed, he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke bread, gave it to them, saying, "This is my body." Now, that's the full version.
Yeah.
Okay. And he says, "Remember, this is what I handed on to you." So obviously the Corinthians have memorized that.
Mm-hmm.
But you turn a few pages later to 1 Corinthians 15, and there's this little staccato creed that is very much like an Epicurean creed that says, "Hote Christos apethenen hupeton hamation hemon katatas graphos," that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. "Kai hoti atafe," that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day, and that he appeared to Kephar toistodeka, and then to the 12. This clearly, everyone recognizes, even the most skeptical scholars recognize, this is the earliest passage summarizing the Christian faith that we have. Skeptical scholars will place this in the 30s AD. And it's a little mnemonic. And it's a mnemonic just like we find in Epicurean schools at the same time, just like we find in primary schools of the same time. It is really good evidence that actually a Christian was not just meant to remember Kai hoti etafe, and that he was buried, but they were then able to be drilled.
Yeah.
By whom and how? And the proof that they could do an expanded version is in 1 Corinthians 11.
Yes.
On the night he was betrayed, he took bread, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we have both the hyper-contraction and the full version just there in 1 Corinthians.
It's such an interesting thing. And the additional remarkable thing about that being, as you say, it being so close to the events that it's claiming to describe. I've heard, again, historians say, you never see this stuff so close. This is, and maybe people just don't realize just how close Paul's letters are, even compared to, say, the Gospels, to the events that they purport to describe.
It is remarkable that we have documents within about 20 years of Jesus that refer to him. These are the letters of Paul. It is more remarkable that we have this little creed in 1 Corinthians 15, which, as I say, even skeptical scholars will place in the 30s.
So within a few years.
Within a few years
of Jesus.
Christians were summarizing their faith as he was the Messiah who died. It was in accordance to the, with the Old Testament. And he had a burial and he rose and he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12.
So where does this leave us then with the kind of the telephone game hypothesis, you know, that, hey, things change as they get passed between people. And by the time it gets written down, it's probably going to look a lot different to what actually happened, you know, when Jesus was traveling around Galilee or whatever. What does all of this information you're giving us kind of say to that kind of what I think is actually a very common hypothesis, even among people who haven't really thought about it? You know, oh, yeah, stuff got changed. And this is the kind of thing that that Dawkins and co. tend to trade on.
It's anachronistic. It's taking what is true of our culture, our no memory culture, and applying it to the ancient world where the ancients were obsessed. I could offer you quote after quote after quote from the ancient period of how important it was to train children from the beginning to memorize things. That's just not our culture anymore, but it was theirs, and we have evidence that they were doing it very early. And so, you know, no one in the study of oral tradition is claiming that it was perfect, but they were absolutely committed to it. And something dawned on me the other day, actually, when I was writing this book, finishing off this book, I think I have accidentally memorized the first seven albums of U2, right? Which is about 8,000 words or something, nearly 10,000 words.
About
which
as
is
long as the Gospel of Mark.
Gospel of Mark.
And why? Why do you know them so well?
Because I used to just sing them all the time. And I used to sing in a band, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And but then you might say, oh, but they were in musical form. No, but this is just an example of how when the memory applies itself to something, it has an amazing capacity to recall information. Yes. Well, imagine growing up in a culture where you thought it was the right thing to do intellectually to memorize things, just as I've memorized U2 lyrics.
It's funny you mention that, because I think we often don't credit as well how much in the Christian tradition singing has been a way which people remember stuff. People, frankly, are more likely to remember theology from songs and from the Bible.
And liturgy would be another.
Yeah, exactly.
Even without the tuneful stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And Christians were doing liturgy from the beginning as well, which is a sort of an outgrowth of this educational program. Mm. And one of the things I'm trying to show is that actually liturgy was not so, in the very early stage, was not so much about worship as about education.
Mm.
The early churches look to the historian like they were little schools, not that they were little cults.
So fascinating. So much more I'd love to talk to you about. Let's just finish off with this. Again, I'm going to play the skeptic here, because this is one that I've come across recently, actually. I did a debate with someone at Oxford University, a skeptic, and he said, if this message is so important, if, you know, everything hangs on this person of Jesus, why has God apparently given it to us in such a corruptible, questionable, historically fragmentary form? You know, wouldn't God surely have preserved this, made it immune from any possible tampering and so on down the centuries? But as far as I'm concerned, all we've got is this very questionable documents, and we're supposed to base our whole belief and worldview on this. God should have done a better job, basically. What's your response to that, I suppose, both as a historian and as a Christian?
Well, it still turned out pretty well, was the first thing I'd say. It still became the largest social movement the world has ever seen. It's still the world's largest religion. So name something that did better.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Even with what he calls a pretty ordinary document. But then I would challenge that it's an ordinary document. Sure, it came in the ordinary way. It came to us just like the Aeneid came to us. People copied it out, and they copied the copies and the copies and the copies and the copies. And now we can line them up all together, and some of the copies are different from others. And, you know, we have to do some work to work out exactly what was the original and so on. Sure. But it actually, in everyone's opinion, people who really know what they're talking about, agree that our New Testament has been really well preserved. Probably the best preserved text from all of classical antiquity. There are others that come close, but the New Testament has an edge on all ancient texts. Well, that tells me something. But as for the kind of messiness of it, I think I would say I like it even theologically, because God came into this messy world humbly, not grandstanding, but in a manger, all the way to a cross. His first people were all, you know, reasonably poor, not destitute, but reasonably poor. They produced documents that reflect a lower socioeconomic environment. And I suppose it might have been more expedient for God to have converted an emperor and then and then forced it on the world with this sort of strict accuracy.
Mm.
But then we'd all be complaining today that it came that way. I think the way God did it, beautifully from below and still changing the world dramatically, is beautiful.
Is Jesus History? ? Is available from the Good Book Company. It's published as part of the resources as well from OCHA, Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. I'll make sure there are links from today's show. But John Dixon, thank you very much for being my guest.
Thank you, Justin.
Don't forget, you can get in touch with the show by emailing me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We're available over on the social media too, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, and facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page, where you can keep updated with all the stuff coming out of the show on a weekly basis. Still to come in the second part of today's show, going to be sitting down with Lydia McGrew and Jonathan McClatchy to talk about her concerns in her new book, The Mirror and the Mask, about certain trends in evangelical scholarship when it comes to the reliability of the gospel account. Stay tuned. We'll be back very shortly.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I'm back with Season 2 of The Big Conversation, a unique video series from the Unbelievable radio show exploring science, faith, philosophy, and what it means to be human. Expect riveting conversations between Christians and atheists, including world-renowned thinkers like Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig.
It's too much like us, like the Greek views of the gods in some sense. They were like too much like us.
They were finite. We're talking about a metaphysically necessary source.
Bart Ehrman.
If the New Testament says that Jesus did X, Y, and Z, did he do it or not?
Peter J. Williams.
I don't think it's a story that's made by committee. Am I going to have a later literary genius who comes up with a great story like this? Or am I going to say, no, Jesus is the genius, and somehow that story has basically been preserved?
And many more. Join the conversation at thebigconversation.show or via the Unbelievable app.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Hope you're enjoying today's show. Tell us what you think of the music I'm trying out on today's edition of the program, mixing up the music for Unbelievable, and be interested to hear what you make of it. Thanks for those who responded to some of the Christmas and New Year editions of the show that we had, Jess and Dean telling their stories on a Christmas edition of the programme, and airing of the panel discussion from Unbelievable the Conference USA last year in the New Year period. Had a lovely tweet from Elaine, who said, "I'm still reeling in a good way from that conference. It was a life-changing couple of days for me." Really glad about that, Elaine. And thanks to all those who have given towards the show as well to support the work of Unbelievable. And as a thank you, have received the video sessions from Unbelievable, the Conference USA. If you want to give yourself, if you haven't had a chance and you'd like to get those video sessions, you can just click on the Give button over at the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And Doug over in Adelaide, Australia, or what's left of it, he says, in parentheses, yes, we've all been watching with concern the bushfires in Australia, but I think we're starting to see that situation come under control. But Doug got in touch to say, just a note to say, I enjoyed the USA conference Q&A session and thought that your winding up comments were spot on. What you said reminded me of one of my favourite quotes from Pascal: God wants to woo our hearts rather than to force our minds to believe in him. There's just enough darkness for those who don't want to believe, but enough light for those who want to believe to have really good evidence and really good reasons for their faith. Thank you very much, Doug, and thanks for listening. More of your feedback later on the show, but for now, time to get into the second part of our gospel-focused edition of the show today. Really pleased in this segment of the programme to be bringing you a conversation between Lydia McGrew and Jonathan McClatchy. We're talking about whether evangelical Christians are no longer defending the historical reliability of the Gospels. In her new book, The Mirror and the Mask, Lydia McGrew makes the case that the Gospel reporters are highly reliable and are reporting in good faith what they believe happened, not changing the facts. But she says the contrasting view gaining popularity among some evangelicals is that the gospel authors considered themselves licensed by the standards of their time to alter facts at times. She particularly criticises scholars such as Mike Licona, whose book Why Are There Differences in the Gospels compares the genre of the Gospels to Plutarch's historical writings, which took licences at various points with the way material was arranged, organised and even invented. Now, it should be said, for this particular conversation, I don't have an alternative viewpoint with us today. Jonathan, very sympathetic to Lydia's point of view. That's partly because we actually did a debate between Craig Evans and Lydia that covered some of this ground a couple of years ago. And when Mike's book came out, I also had him on for a discussion with Richard Burridge, where Mike's own thesis wasn't challenged. So probably this is setting the stage for at some point getting Lydia on with someone like Mike or whoever. For the moment, we're just going to kind of set the scene here and talk about the book in that way. So Lydia, welcome along to the programme. Great to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Justin. Thank you.
And Jonathan, welcome back from your faraway places. I think Boston is now where you're mainly to be found.
Yeah, that's right. I currently live in Boston, Massachusetts, where I teach biology at a Christian college called Sattler College. I teach biology to first years and second years there.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to having you on for a full edition of the program discussing the resurrection soon. Mm-hmm. But Apologetics Academy is a good place for people to find out more about you and all the apologetics resources that you work on.
That's right. And the address for that is apologetics-academy.org.
Great stuff. Lydia, coming back to you first of all, this has been bubbling away for a little time now, and you've kind of taken the time to actually put it out in this book, The Mirror and the Mask. Tell us, firstly, what does the title, which is a rather interesting one, refer to, The Mirror and the Mask?
So The Mirror or the Mask refers to two different ways of looking at the Gospels. If they're a mirror, they give us an accurate picture of Jesus by way of normal processes like testimony. But if the agendas of their individual authors and the changes they decided to make are altering those reports to be contrary to fact, then the Gospels put a mask over Jesus and, to some degree, greater or lesser, obscure the true facts about him. And it's going to be more difficult for us to tell what the true facts are.
And where do you see this happening in particular? And what do you think is driving this particular way in which you feel some scholars in this area are deciding to a new understanding, let's say, of how the Gospels were written?
Well, I think that there is a lot of weariness with harmonizing the Gospels. Harmonizing involves putting them together, if there's an apparent discrepancy, seeing if that can be reconciled. And I think a fair number of evangelicals, especially those who state that they adhere to inerrancy, are coming to feel that harmonizing is problematic or that it doesn't work in quite a number of cases. And this sets up quite a tension if you think there's an irresolvable discrepancy, but you say that you do not want to call it an error. In that context, the claim that these were literary devices that were accepted at the time is very attractive. So someone like Dr. Michael Licona or Craig Evans will talk about what he calls crea. We debated that a year and a half ago or so. They're on Unbelievable. They will say, so that was just accepted at the time. They were just allowed to change things. And I think that seems attractive to those who want simultaneously to say there are irresolvable discrepancies, but also not to consider them to be errors. So then that's a big difference with me, because I would say if you are not going to call it an error, You might just need to say, I don't know, if you think there's a discrepancy, and just wait it out, wait for something better to come along, and that would be actually less harmful to the reliability of the Gospels than to say that they felt licensed to change things.
I mean, I was quite sympathetic towards Michael Licona's way of doing this. He came on my show, he talked about it with Richard Burridge, as you know, and I felt there is something there in the fact that we have to accept that these were written at a different time and place where different kind of standards applied literarily. So we're not going to expect a kind of newspaper report that we might have today, or biographical standards that might kind of be, you know, the standard in the 20th century or whatever. So, I mean, to what extent do you feel that there is some truth in that, and to what extent does it take it too far as you're concerned, Lydia?
Well, I tend to think of there as being a difference of principle, not a difference of degree, between, for example, just leaving out some facts and changing facts. So I think a phrase like they didn't report always with the same detail that we would expect, for example, that can be a little ambiguous because it makes it sound like they're just leaving things out. Dr. Lacona is very fond of the phrase the guy version and the girl version, and that, you know, they're just hitting the bullet points or something like that. But when you come to actually changing the time when something happened, and, for example, John, say, reporting that Jesus cleansed the temple early in his ministry, and let's say you believe that John is changing that he really only cleansed the temple later in his ministry, that's not just leaving some things out. That's not just narrating ambiguously. And I would call that not just, quote, taking things too far, but actually a kind of a radical difference.
If I can just take that one example. So, yes, it's pretty well known that in John's gospel, a cleansing of the temple happens right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. And the other three gospels all have that happening sort of in the, you know, the passion time, sort of in the week running up to his crucifixion. And so a lot of scholars say, well, it's the same event, but John has just chosen to kind of put it at the beginning for theological reasons. And they weren't too concerned about where these things happened, you know, chronologically as we are, you know, but it happened. And it does. So your view is, though, that that does present a worrying trend if Christians are willing to say, yes, the gospel writers were at license to move events around in that way.
Yeah, that's 3 years, 3.5 years. And I actually examined the claim that there was a literary device at the time of displacement where you would change something and so that the audience, for example, of the Gospels would have just known that that could be happening. Notice that they wouldn't necessarily know that it was happening there. They would just go in there and sort of hold all of that lightly the way we might if we were watching a movie based on true events. Yeah. We would say, oh, well, they might have moved something by a few years, but I'd have to go look it up on Wikipedia or whatever to find out if they really did. I actually find wanting the evidence for the existence of that kind of norm or genre, and that the Gospels were in that kind of norm or genre. So it's not even just like I'm offended by it. I just don't think the evidence supports that, that's how they would have thought of it.
That's interesting. Jonathan, be interested in your take on all this. I mean, you've got your ear to the ground when it comes to apologetic circles. Do you find that the kind of way Mike Lacona, Burridge, Craig Evans, and so on are doing this kind of analysis of the gospel writings is becoming more and more mainstream in the circles you're moving in?
Yeah, absolutely. It's becoming mainstream in apologetic discourse. I can think of and this is affecting many prominent scholars in evangelical circles. There are examples in the works of Craig Keener, for example, a scholar for whom I have much respect, and I know Lydia does as well, and yet he uses many of these approaches when it comes to gospel differences. There's others, William Lane Craig has examples of this sort of phenomena as well. Just to clarify something in regards to what you were discussing with Lydia a moment ago, in relation to moving events around, such as the cleansing of the temple, was it at the end of Jesus' ministry per the synoptics, or was it at the beginning of Jesus' ministry as per John? I would make a distinction, which of course Lydia makes in her book as well, between achronological narration and dischronological narration. So there are examples in the Gospels where events are not narrated in chronological sequence, and they are narrated, you might say, achronologically. But when it comes to something like the cleansing of the temple in John chapter 2, John actually represents it as happening early in Jesus' ministry. And so that's the fundamental difference. He actually represents it at the time of year. It was during the Passover, and the Jews say it's taken us 4 to 6 years to build this temple, which which corresponds to approximately 28 CE. Right. So it's the beginning of Jesus' ministry.
So how do you resolve it then? Is the answer for you, Jonathan, that there were two cleansings of the temple? That's
correct. I would take the view that there were two cleansings of the temple. And I think that we can ground the cleansing of the temple historically as being anchored in the beginning of Jesus' ministry. For instance, when did Herod the Great start or commence construction of the temple? Well, that was in the 18th year of his reign, which falls around 19 BC. Well, if you take 46 years on from there, you land in you land in 28 AD. Luke's Gospel in chapter 3 gives the date for the beginning of Jesus' ministry as the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius. Tiberius was taken as co-emperor with Augustus around 12 AD. And so the 14th year from then would land in around the fall of 27 AD. And the cleansing of the temple, according to John's Gospel, is happening the following Passover, which also lands you in 28 AD. So you have two independent means of corroborating the date of that event.
Now, when it comes to the way you understand the Bible, Jonathan, you are an inerrantist, I think it's fair to say.
So it depends what you mean by that term. Mm. Of course, we'd have to flesh out. I mean, I think that Lydia's view of Scripture, even as a non-inerrantist, is actually higher than someone like Michael Lacona, who would claim the label of inerrancy and yet claim that the he would define inerrancy such that it allows for the gospel authors to feel at liberty to change events deliberately and so forth.
I mean, what's your view on this? Because I think the inerrancy thing does play in here, Lydia. I think the reason some people have got very concerned with, for instance, Mike Lacona's work, you know, not least Norm Geisler before he passed away, of course, who was very, very critical of some of the way Mike understood things, was because they were concerned it was somehow undermining a doctrine of inerrancy. Now, as I understand it, you don't actually hold to that doctrine yourself, Lydia. So in a way, it doesn't sound
I do not.
So it doesn't sound like that's your concern particularly.
Yeah, so it plays in both ways. And as I said earlier, I think some people, because they're inerrantists, want to adopt the literary device view, because then they can kind of have their cake and eat it too. They can be inerrantists and yet not harmonize in places where they feel uncomfortable about harmonizing or something like that. So I think that there are some places, even in the Gospels, where the best explanation available is probably that the author made a small good faith error. I would be willing to be convinced otherwise, but I consider that a pretty simple explanation, especially compared to these literary device views. It's what we would unhesitatingly go for in a similar real life case, if I may put it that way, real life or contemporary case, before we would think that the author was inventing what happened or that he had a deep theological purpose, that was a literary device. We also know that good faith, truthful, knowledgeable witnesses can make small errors while still being highly reliable. We have kind of an inductive notion of that. It's a well-known type of thing. We have much less idea what to expect if a person thinks he's licensed to invent invisible changes or falsehoods. So that's why I find that old-style inerrantists really appreciate both my honesty and my refusal to change the meaning, because that really is a change of the meaning of the term inerrancy. So you mentioned Norm Geisler. I can say this, that I have a witness who can confirm this. A good friend of his, Christopher Hahn, was reading some portions of my book to him on his deathbed. He didn't get very far with it, but telling him about it. And Dr. Geisler was going to endorse the mirror or the mask,
right,
despite knowing that I was not an inerrantist. It was made very clear to him, but he passed away before he could do that. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about Plutarch, because, as I say, I have been very sympathetic to Mike's arguments in that book that came out a couple of years ago, Why the Differences in the Gospels. And he does very much take Plutarch, another historian of that era, and show the various ways, the various literary devices that were common at the time that Plutarch employed, sort of telescoping, spotlighting, moving things around chronologically, and various other things, and saying, and here are parallels in various of the Gospels where this happened. And so we shouldn't be upset or surprised that the gospel writers wrote in the same genre as other historical writers. It's still perfectly historical, but they just had more liberty to do things that we might not do today with our biographical writing. So first of all, is that what's going on? What are these literary devices? Do you think there is this overlap? And it sounds like you're saying you don't find as much evidence for that as Mike obviously thinks there is.
Right. Well, I disagree with him at multiple levels. So I am unconvinced that the fact-changing devices are even in Plutarch either. And that's part of why my book is rather long. If you get it, it's kind of a big book because I actually go back to Plutarch. Now, even if they were, it wouldn't follow that the gospel authors are following them. And in the genre of biography, you could have people who were very, very conscientious so that it doesn't follow that they would feel that they could use these. But it we have to distinguish Plutarch's making mistakes, or even if Plutarch lied or were propagandistic, that's not even a literary device. We have liars today and propagandists today. Now, I don't have any place in mind where I think Plutarch lied, actually. What I tend to do when I go back is I find that the theorists, such as Dr. Lacona, are jumping to the conclusion that Plutarch is engaging in this. I call their method discrepancy hunting, that they find what appears to them to be a discrepancy between two of Plutarch's lives, and then they say, he's using a literary device where there are much simpler explanations. I can give examples of that. I give many in the book. In the interest of time, maybe I won't give one right here, but it's fascinating how you can just harmonize Plutarch with very ordinary, real-world kinds of things. I should also mention that spotlighting is not changing facts. It's something that old harmonizers used all the time, which is just focusing on one person in the story rather than someone else. So that's not even factual change. That's not even different from what we would do today, and it's not the thing I have a problem with.
Yeah.
So I actually don't find these literary devices in Plutarch either, and that's a very interesting thing to say. Plus, I think that the gospel authors had special reasons for being extra careful and conscientious because they were writing about Jesus, who was the Savior of the world, and that God came in history, so history and accuracy in history would have been especially important to them.
I mean, very often, obviously, a lot of the issues come about, you know, because of the resurrection stories and some of the differences that it involved there. And there is either the kind of harmonization approach and saying, well, this person arrived here and that person arrived there, and perhaps we're spotlighting here. And actually, there are no direct contradictions in all of this. It can all be true at the same time. And others who maybe take them a different approach where they're saying, actually, you know, there are essentially contradictions, but we can understand that because of literary devices and so on. Now, interestingly, the last time I had you on for a resurrection debate, I think, Jonathan, you were debating, was it Robert Alter?
Michael Alter.
Michael Alter, yes. Yeah. I'm getting my Alters confused. And I think at the time you would have said that you adopted what, you know, again, popularized to some extent by Mike Lacona, the minimal facts hypothesis for the resurrection. Habermas, Lacona and others, you know, have really come up with this. And I've used it myself on many an occasion to say, hey, even if you're highly skeptical of the Gospels and their historicity, here are some central facts that the vast majority of historians agree, whether they be Christian or not. Things like, you know, the empty tomb, the appearance of Jesus to the disciples, conversions, the death of Jesus on the cross. Just with those facts alone, historically speaking, you can make a case for the resurrection. Now, you've actually, I think, come to sort of slightly be more critical, actually, of that approach to defending
right.
the resurrection. Do you want to explain why that is, Jonathan?
Yeah, so very briefly. So the minimal facts criteria that were coined by Gary Habermas and promoted by and popularized by Michael Lacona et al. Is to say that in order for a fact to qualify as a minimal fact, it must have a high majority. And Gary Habermas says that it has to be accepted by 90-something percent of scholars who acknowledge a particular fact. It must have scholars, including skeptics across the theological spectrum, who agree with that fact. And a few of the facts that he claims would qualify under those minimal fact criteria are the fact that Jesus died due to crucifixion, that very soon afterwards Jesus' disciples had experiences that they believed were appearances of the resurrected Christ, and just a few years later, Saul of Tarsus had an experience of what he believed to be his resurrection appearance of the risen Jesus. And yes, these are accepted across the theological spectrum by New Testament critics today. However, there are certain scenarios that are consistent with the appearance fact, and yet which I do not think compel belief in the resurrection. For example, a floating, non-speaking Jesus. Jesus who appears only once, briefly, and speaks only a few words. And these scenarios are, in fact, weak or even disconfirmatory of a bodily resurrection hypothesis. And so if we're not able to say in detail what the experiences were like, it becomes very difficult for us to determine the rationality of the beliefs of the disciples. If we're only going to limit ourselves to the letters of Paul, for example, I don't think that we can say that the resurrection experiences were claimed to be polymodal or multisensory in nature, involving not just sight, but group conversations with Jesus, physical contact with Jesus, eating breakfast with Jesus on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. And according to Acts 1, it was extended across 40 days. So it wasn't just one brief and confusing episode that the disciples experienced. That material is found in the Gospels. In fact, recently I was speaking at the Unbelievable Discussion Meetup Group, and one of the questions that came up in that discussion was, how can we tell from Paul's letters that his resurrection experience was qualitatively different from that of the other apostles? Because according to Acts 9, and Paul hints at this himself, his resurrection experience was qualitatively different. He saw a bright light shining at him, and he didn't seem to experience the bodily presence of Jesus in front of him in the same sense that the other apostles did. My response to that is to point to the author Luke, who wrote Luke Acts. And Luke, I think we can show overwhelming evidence, was a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. And I think you can make a strong case that he represents Pauline thought. And so since Luke clearly believed that the resurrection experiences of the other apostles was qualitatively different from that of Paul, I think we can infer justifiably that likewise that was Paul's view as well.
So, I mean, if you put a label on it now, I mean, is it a maximal view of the resurrection?
So we call this the maximal data approach. And basically the distinction of the maximal data approach is that we assert up front that the gospel resurrection accounts represent what the disciples actually claimed happened to them. I would argue that we can actually ground the Gospels and Acts in substantially reliable eyewitness testimony, credible eyewitness.
And in that sense, we're not, in a sense... I suppose that means you're not at the mercy of scholarly change and consensus changing over time, you know, because I think that was the attractive thing to some extent about what Gary Habermas did. He said, even if I, you know, take the most liberal scholars and the conservatives and put them all down, here are the things that they all actually agree on. But you feel that actually we should just treat the Gospels as what they claim to be eyewitness sources.
Right. I would argue that you cannot divorce the case for the resurrection from the reliability of the Gospels and Acts. You cannot do it solely with the letters of Paul.
Okay. Lydia, what are your thoughts on this? Because I've seen you also weighing in on this, that you feel that we're missing a trick if we simply go with the what has become very popular, a sort of apologetic strategy of the minimal facts around the resurrection.
Right. I did a webinar on Jonathan's Apologetics Academy called Minimal Facts versus Maximal Data, where I made some of the points that Jonathan has just been making. The interesting thing to me is that when a person begins with minimal facts, they're going to have to move beyond it pretty swiftly in pretty short order. I think we saw this in a symposium that was in the journal Philosophy of Christi some years ago between some evangelical scholars and Dale Allison. I'm not quite sure what to call Dale Allison, an evangelical fellow traveler or something, who questions the bodily resurrection. And Allison was questioning that. He kind of likes this idea of grief hallucinations and so forth. And Gary Habermas was quite rightly in that symposium talking about some of the facts Jonathan just alluded to. Skeptics saw Jesus. Jesus was tangible. They saw him inside and outside. He ate with them, these things. And Allison, in his response to Habermas, said, well, but to do that, to say that, you would have to use the gospel accounts of the resurrection. And how is Gary going to argue, how is Habermas going to argue that these were reliable? This is widely thought that they were embellished and so forth. So, and he was right that you would have to argue that they weren't just embellished. So right there in that dialogue, you got beyond minimal facts immediately. So my thought is, you're going to have to go there eventually, so you might as well be prepared to go there and say it right up front, because it doesn't really matter whether you start with minimal facts or not. That's not going to take you all the way.
I mean, maybe a final question to bring this to a close, Lydia. The Mirror or the Mask, as I said, is the new book. But you're responding in many ways to, you know, long-standing Bible scholars, people who have done this for their whole lives and, you know, write papers on it and so on. I don't think that is your background, Lydia. And I suppose a natural question someone might ask is what qualifies you to sort of speak into this and to criticize some of these, you know, well-known scholars in this area?
Sure. Well, for one thing, I have my background is in philosophy and probability theory and the theory of knowledge. So I consider that to be quite relevant, because very often what these scholars are doing is what is called applied epistemology, applied theory of knowledge. They're talking about what the evidence shows. They'll explicitly say, this is what we can know from the evidence, that kind of thing. So I consider they're often doing applied epistemology, and they're doing it badly. So one thought would be, what's a complex theory that's too complex? How does theory simplicity or ad hocness play into this? These are areas of my direct professional research where I've published, and I can see that, I think, somewhat more clearly than these scholars at times, not only because of my professional background, but because I don't have that guild loyalty and mentality that's locking me into certain rigid theories. I can come from an outsider perspective and give a fresh perspective. The other thing is that in a lot of these areas like Plutarch that we were talking about, it's a matter of hard legwork more than of esoteric information. And so if you're willing to put in that legwork, which I think my book testifies and speaks for itself that I have done, you can actually critique these just by going and reading it and saying, well, that's not necessarily a contradiction, or that's not implausible that both of these things happened and so forth. You don't need some kind of highly, highly specialized information that I'm simply lacking. And I would encourage readers to see that when they read the book. So I think that's an interesting thing, that you can't just go with credentials and pick a credentialed scholar and follow him. I would also point out, credentialed scholars disagree among themselves. You know, Craig Blomberg is going to harmonize a lot more than Michael Lacona. So is Peter Williams, who endorsed The Mirror or The Mask, and you've had him on your show recently. So if someone is going to go with credentialed scholars, what are they going to do, flip a coin to decide which one to agree with or follow? So that's where I encourage people to delve into this for themselves and not to be put off by the credentialist concern.
Well, it's been really great having you both on the show today. I am acutely aware, of course, that we've mentioned a number of individuals who we should give a right of reply to. So I'd hope we're all open to having a discussion with a Mike Lacona or, again, a Craig Evans or whoever in the room to talk about these differences. But I wanted to do this today with yourself and Jonathan, Lydia, because I did give the opportunity for Mike and Richard Burridge in that show a couple of years ago to kind of speak from the same standpoint, really, on their view of how to do that, to understand these differences in the Gospels. So it's been really interesting to have you on. I hope to have you on again in the not-too-distant future. But for the moment, The Mirror or The Mask, it's available wherever you get your books from online. And if you want to find out more about Lydia, lydiamcgrew.com will bring you somewhere where you can get links to her blogs and such forth. So thank you very much for being a guest on the show today, Lydia.
Thank you for having me, Justin. It's been great.
And Jonathan, looking forward to having you back again in the not too distant future. We're going to be debating the resurrection. Maybe you can pull out your maximal data for that one.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Justin.
I'll be back after a short break with the final part of today's edition of the program. A chance to sit down and look at some of your feedback from the last few weeks, and what a lot there's been to our shows dealing with morality. Glenn Scrivener and Matt Dillahunty on The Big Conversation for that one. And Christian Atheism and the Madness of Crowds, Douglas Murray and Esther O'Reilly. We'll see what you had to say in response to some of those shows. Stay tuned, this is Unbelievable.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Trying out some new show music, as I've said we will do at the opening part of the year. So tell me what you thought of today's. I've had some positive and some negative comments on the last time I did this with the Douglas Murray and Esther O'Reilly show right at the beginning of the year. But be interested in hearing what you think of this particular choice of music. I'm going to be giving this section of the show entirely over now to your feedback from recent weeks, because frankly I have not had a chance to go through much of the feedback recently, and when I printed it all off this morning there was so much, and I've just had to select some of the best bits here. Before we get into that, just a reminder that straight after Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio, you can hear The Profile. Katia Adams is sitting down to talk about her new book, Equal, in which she talks through her journey moving from a complementarian theology of church and gender to an egalitarian view about the role of women and men in ministry. That's also available on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And if you're coming back for Unbelievable next week, excited to be joined by Cosmic Skeptic, who's been on the show a few times now, aka Alex O'Connor. He's a very popular YouTube atheist, and he's going to be in conversation with young Oxford philosopher Max Baker Hitch, and they're going to be discussing the argument from reason, something that I've referenced a few times now, both in conversation with Stephen Woodford, another well-known atheist YouTuber, and Alex himself as well on his own podcast. So they're going to be doing a proper discussion on it next week. Really looking forward to filming that one, recording that one, and sending it out, see what you make of it as well. Before I get to your feedback, a reminder as well from friend of the show, Ed Atkinson, who's one of the people who organises the Unbelievable London discussion group between Christians and sceptics, to say they had a great time with Jonathan McClatchy earlier on in the month. He filled the room, very appreciative feedback. And they're meeting again on February the 3rd, 7:30 p.m. as usual, the Cock Tavern near King's Cross, for a discussion on Undefended Faith, a Postmodern Pre-Constantinian Perspective. Their speaker will be the Reverend Dr. Howard Worsley. Howard's not only married to a C of E bishop, he's also the tutor in mission at the Anglican Training College, Trinity College in Bristol, where he's the vice principal. So that sounds absolutely fascinating. Undefended Faith with Reverend Dr. Howard Worsley will be at the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic London discussion group on the 3rd of February. Go to their meetup page for more information. If you want to get in touch about anything you heard on today's show or anything that I'm going to be bringing in this feedback section, do feel free to email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk or tweet at unbelievablejb for my Twitter account, and the Facebook page is easily findable on Facebook if you look for Unbelievable. This is from Paul Rees on Twitter, who says, "Thanks Justin for the consistently excellent job you do hosting and chairing discussions. I've listened for years and so appreciate the gracious and even way you guide these conversations on foundational and controversial topics." Very encouraging tweet to get from you. Thank you very much, Paul. And Vaz wanted to ask, could we think about bringing this person on the show? Guest suggestion, S. Joshua Swamidas has a new book out called The Genealogical Adam and Eve. The book is receiving rave reviews from both evolutionists and creationists. I'd love to hear a discussion where Swamidas is challenged by a creationist and an evolutionist who reject his theory. Would be interesting to hear how he defends his hypothesis. Very timely email, Vaz, because I've just been in touch with Joshua himself to organise such a show. Now, it's actually going to be in conversation with a non-Christian and atheist who actually is very sympathetic towards his position. And I've only really just looked at this position myself. It does sound fascinating, the way he marries modern science, evolutionary science, with the Adam and Eve story. But he still has, you know, differences of opinion, obviously, on the Christian interpretation of that. So we'll bring your show along the lines of what you're looking for in due course. Lots of exciting shows actually lining up for 2020. Got another show on the origin of life that we're lining up between none other than Jim Tour, who's a well-known person in the field, coming on to discuss it with a previous show guest, Lee Cronin, who's been doing that research, which claims to show that he is discovering a material origin for the origins of life on Earth. So that'll be a fascinating one as well. Okay, so let's go to some of your feedback to recent shows. Glenn Scrivener and Matt Dillahunty. What a show that was to finish off The Big Conversation Season 2 last week. Lots of reaction to this online. Glenn himself over at Speak Life has posted a couple of post-debate videos responding to it. They're well worth your time and attention. There's also some very funny kind of response meme-y type videos going on. One of Matt Dillahunty's spin doctor, which I found quite amusing, based off taking some clips, I think, from a video that was initially aimed at the Prince Andrew situation, and also a funny video in which Glenn does the jerk head bounce, which was a criticism of an atheist listener underneath that show, and which then got turned into Glenn's jerk head bounce to various different tracks. But anyway, to some of the more substantive discussions on this. Thanks for Andrew on Facebook, who says, "Dang, Justin, there you go, setting up an awesome conversation again. Thank you for the Matt and Glenn conversation on morality. Glenn did superb. That's the kind of conversations we need to see, in my opinion." And as a reminder, they were debating, can atheism deliver a better world? This is from Dathin, who says, "Matt is often quite rude and arrogant. It was nice to see him behaving, and it shows how important face-to-face conversation is." By the way, a lot of these first ones are going to be from Twitter, as people responded to that. James Croft, former guest on the show, he's a humanist chaplain, says, "Very interesting discussion. I would be interested to see Glenn Scrivener offer evidence, as he said, that it is intrinsic religiosity, which relates to positively to various civic and personal traits. My research suggests that it is religious participation rather than religiosity." And there was an interesting back and forth on Twitter between yourself and Glenn, wasn't there, James, about that subject. Maybe we could do that in more depth at some point in the future. Jeff said, "Absolutely fantastic conversation on the subject of morality from the perspective of an atheist and a Christian. Both made thought-provoking points." And this one from John said, "One of the best conversations I've heard on morality from both a Christian and atheist perspective. Both men giving a fair assessment of each other's positions. Matt, when pushed, fell back to his usual rhetoric, but other than that, an excellent debate in which Glenn excelled." So that's some of the response over on Twitter. On the email, Matthew Taylor gets in touch to say, "The question, can atheism deliver a better world, doesn't make any sense, because as Matt pointed out, atheism doesn't attempt to do that and doesn't claim to do so. Christianity makes that claim. So the question should be asked of Christianity or any other ideology that claims to deliver a better world. We also need to agree what's meant by better. If Christians get to decide what's meant by better, then they're always going to define better as that which is delivered by Christianity, which means any discussion is going to go in circles." You also had some question marks around the studies that Glenn pointed out as to the way intrinsic religiosity benefits society and individuals. There were people who questioned, where are these thousands of studies that Glenn referenced? If you go and check out his response video, he has posted some links to the research that he was talking about there. This one from Paul says, "I don't think Matt was well placed to defend his side because he admitted there is no objective purpose or value to the human race. That leaves you with no objective measure which would allow you to say that one society is better than another. It's purely preference. So it was like Matt was in outer space but trying to head east. He can say such a direction is east, but he's just made that up. In outer space, there is no east. And in an atheistic world, it's no better. Without God, no society is better than another. It's just different because humans have no ultimate purpose." Okay, thank you very much, Paul. I'm just reading really some segments of some of these emails because I've got a lot to get through here. This one from Prescott said, "My understanding of Matt's position is that he believes in objective morality to the extent that if everyone agrees on a goal, i.e. well-being, you have the closest thing to what might be an objective morality. However, he fails to acknowledge that it's quite literally impossible to have every single person agree on what a goal is because of different culture, language, desires, socioeconomic status, general preferences, etc. Simply too much diversity within humanity to be able to find a particular issue on which every single person would say, yes, that is morally right or wrong. This starts to break down because for any given goal at hand, you would have to essentially disregard those who disagree with it. And that's what Glenn seemed to warn about regarding the ever-shrinking circle of who's in and who's out. Some issues will lend themselves to disregarding fewer people people than other issues, but it will never be zero. I think Matt recognises this, which is why he's so hesitant to say that all people have value when Glenn pressed him. I found that shocking, by the way. Thank you very much, Prescott. That was the point in the debate, which was highlighted by that rather funny spin doctor bit as well, if you go and look for that one. Adam in Arlington, Texas says, how can anyone listen to Matt Dillahunty and find reason to hold on to their faith? Glenn had no real response to Matt's very well thought out questions and answers. Thanks for having him on. Okay, thanks, Adam. He obviously felt that Matt won the day on that one. Art Klim is another skeptic who got in touch. Art's been listening to the show since early on, shortly after it began, says Art, and we've been in touch, I know, for some time over those years. Yours is one of two or three podcasts that I never miss. You're interviewing second to none. Most importantly, you treat people fairly on your show. Always appreciate that kind of encouragement, Art, especially from someone who's coming from the skeptical side. And you have a long email, won't be able to read it all out here, in which you come back on some of Glenn Scrivener's points, saying that he claimed that the Judeo-Christian ethic supports the sanctity of every human life. Really? Well, the Bible says that God killed every man, woman and child on earth by drowning, except for eight members of one family. Today, waterboarding is condemned as torture. Why? Because it simulates drowning, a terrifying way to die. Presumably, an omnipotent God could have killed them by any method, but the Bible tells us God chose the most terrifying way to kill every man, woman and child on earth, except Noah's family. So apparently, the Judeo-Christian ethic, or God's ethic, doesn't consider every human life to be valuable. And you go on to give other examples in Scripture where you feel that's the case as well. You also talk about anti-Semitism and the fact that obviously Christians have been involved in that, and also that the evangelical Christians who led the abolition of the slave trade were also opposed by other Christians. So yes, all of these I think Glenn would have been happy to respond to had they come up in one way or another on the show, and they have it of course in other shows as well. But I guess I would simply say that we've done, as I'm sure you're aware as a long time listener, Art, a number of shows dealing with those issues around Old Testament scriptures and how we're supposed to understand and interpret them as regards to God's character. But even if you took a very literal view on that, I think you could argue that God, as the creator of human life, doesn't thereby devalue human life by taking life away. That's God's prerogative, if you like. It's the question is, is there an intrinsic, inherent, if you like, value to human life at all from an atheist perspective? But I appreciate those are big issues, and that's not a terribly satisfactory answer in a short time. This is coming from Alex, who says, just finished that conversation between Glenn and Matt. Really interesting. Have to admit that at times I wish you would take a stronger stance, particularly when a guest like Matt claims that the Bible supports slavery, etc. To make statements as this and others, pass them off as fact and not dispute it, is at least annoying. That's probably just my old cantankerous self butting up against positions that I once held as an atheist. You go on to say here, Alex, I can't help but think that Matt's view and that of many atheists I encounter are based on straw men. Anyone can misquote or misunderstand the Bible when they haven't perhaps read it for themselves. It's easy to knock down a view of God that is not the Christian view of God and make it seem plausible to those who also have God as a straw man. I loved when you pushed back on that, Glenn. It was a great moment. Unfortunately, when Matt can't or won't answer, he pivots immediately away. But I think you made your points. And Alex, you go on to say, Glenn, you have a unique way of using language to explain ideas, and the way you explained the we and us and a narrowing circle around those who deserve human dignity, who's in and who's out, was really powerful. When you brought the conversation back from the one about Hitler to the live issue of the elimination of people with Down syndrome, Matt refused to deal with the live issue, preferring to say with his roundtable discussion, talking Hitler out of mass murder. Not because it was wrong on any level, but because, well, actually, I don't really know that there was a because. Thank you very much, Alex. This was from Eric as well, regular listener and communicator to the show. Says, great show with Matt and Glenn. I'm intrigued by arguments from secular humanists like Matt, who try to convince us that God is irrelevant to morality, but find that despite their best efforts, they fail at the foundational level. No one should be surprised that atheists can behave morally. The problem is not their goodness, but rather their inability to regulate badness. As Ravi Zacharias has stated, the measure of a religion or philosophy is not how much good it does, but rather how much evil it allows. It may call us to good behaviour, but make no prohibitions on our bad behaviour. You go on to say that I think the problem is that Matt doesn't have a good understanding of what the foundational beliefs that need explaining actually are. I'd argue there are some very basic aspects of the world that every worldview must explain. Firstly, that humans are vastly different from anything found in nature. We exhibit characteristics that cannot be found in the world around us, such as love, compassion, worship, morality, purpose, and creativity. Our uniqueness is not defined by our physical features, but by our immaterial or spiritual qualities. Secondly, you say humans believe the world should be better than it is. Why do we humans think there is something wrong with the world in the first place? If we evolved over millions of years through the process of natural selection, why did we wake up one morning and think that death of the unfit wasn't very pleasant after all? Thirdly, humans believe that the problem with the world is humans. We don't blame animals or plants for the world's problems, but we're quick to point the finger at humans. Herding cats is hard, but making humans behave is nearly impossible. Since we know that man isn't a beast, the rules of the jungle don't apply, so we have a conundrum. We know that humans are both awesome and awful. Unable to find our problem in our physical nature, we're forced to face the fact that we are spiritually broken. And fourth and finally, humans convicted by the above facts then have no choice but to turn to the spiritual realm to fix it, enter religion. There's a lot more to your email than that, Eric, but I thought you made some interesting points there. So that's just some of the response that came into to Matt and Glenn debating morality on that show of last week. You're welcome to send in more of your thoughts on that as well. Lots of response as well to the one that started off the new year. Really interesting conversation between Douglas Murray, the author of The Madness of Crowds, himself an atheist, but describes himself as a Christian atheist. And we talked at some length about that with my other guest, Esther O'Reilly, who's a Christian blogger. And here's a whole bunch of tweets that came in. Lots of people tweeting on the back of this one. So this was Human Affairs tweeted, "The world needs an apologetic book from you someday, Justin. Not how to destroy atheists with the teleological fine-tuning argument, but written to someone like Douglas, seeking to remain in God's shadow, but incapable of looking upwards towards its origin." This one from Chris said, "Just finished listening. Outstanding back and forth, particularly from about 40 minutes in. To me, Douglas clearly not completely shut the door." This one says, from Mark, says, "Very impressed at all of Esther's literary name drops. For a math scholar, you sure do spend a lot of time in the wrong part of the library. Lovely discussion. Very impressed at the tone of your final comments. But these three things shall remain." Amir said, "I've yearned for a platform for true dialogue, and you've provided everyone, not just podcasters, but society, with the perfect blueprint. Thank you. Love the show." Thank you, Amir. Lots of people commenting on the way Esther handled that dialogue, particularly towards the end, where she sort of gently probed and offered, if you like, Douglas her kind of a gentle form of evangelism, inviting him to consider again the claims of Christianity. Brian says, "The episode with Esther O'Reilly and Douglas Murray, amazing. So blown away by how Esther took that turn at the end to swing an intellectual conversation into skillful evangelism. Awe-inspiring, to say the least." Vicky in the North has really enjoyed listening to this today. "Great discussion. I'm a fan of Douglas Murray already. Now want to find out more about Esther O'Reilly." And Choo Choo said, "Really good and enjoyable. Only more appreciation for Douglas Murray." Similar sentiments from Sam McKee, saying it was outstanding as usual. And the Reasonable Doctor, who sent in a tweet saying, "So good was this. I've listened to it again. The most poignant moment was when Esther O'Reilly quoted from Eliot right at the end. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Spine shivers, says Reasonable Doctor. Patty, "That was a very powerful part of the show," she says. "I listened while cooking and was enthralled from start to finish. Now I have to listen again with pen and paper in hand." Thank you, Drew Dick. This is the way you came to the show, I think, for introducing me to the thoughtful, intelligent dialogue of Unbelievable. And now to Esther. And Adam Friended, who's a friend of the show and an atheist himself, says, "I call myself a Christian atheist, and I'm glad to see Murray boosting the idea. As a culture, we should embrace anyone who respects the concepts of forgiveness and humility that Jesus teaches." This one from Amanda, "Very nice chat with much honesty and graciousness from Douglas Murray regarding his religious journey. I thought he was very honest about the difficulties of accepting faith for people with a rational mind." And another one from someone describing himself as a lifelong atheist says, "I've realized in the last few years that Western Christianity gave me the intellectual and social space to be an atheist, and for that I'm grateful. However, the bottom line is there is no God, so being grateful is as far as it can go." And Kay says, "Great chat. Even if you could validate every historical aspect of the Gospels. For many of us, it's impossible to reconcile claims of divinity or suspensions of natural order, muddied further by the fact miracles attributed to other gods are still claimed and corroborated today. And I'll finish with this tweet from Lisa, who said, "I found it fascinating. I'd love to see a conversation between Douglas Murray and Rupert Sheldrake. I can see how they might agree and disagree and have a fascinating chat. Has Sheldrake been on The Unbelievable Show?" Yes, he has, actually, Lisa. If you go back a couple of years in the archives now, he had a really interesting chat with Susan Blackmore on consciousness and science. I'm hoping we might bring Rupert back on again in the not-too-distant future. So there you go. Just some of the responses we've received on Twitter to that programme. Partly that amount of Twitter responses down to the fact that Esther O'Reilly, the other guest on the programme, is a keen Twitter user herself, and so a lot of people responding to her posting about the show. And a mutual friend, George Brahm, who runs the Cogent Christianity website, has done a great blog as well for us, for the Unbelievable blog, that you might want to go and check out on that discussion between Esther and Douglas Murray. I think we titled it Douglas Murray Cherishes Christianity, What's Stopping Him from Becoming a Believer, or something like that. George actually has also written a great blog as well on that Matt Dillahunty and Glenn Scrivener episode as well for the Big Conversation blog. So worth going and checking those out. I do post those always on our social media, and that's why it's always worth following us, or indeed making sure you're subscribed to the Unbelievable newsletter, which makes sure you get all that stuff on a fortnightly basis. Again, all the links are available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Just click on newsletter and you'll get the newsletter. As I mentioned last week, we are also sending the Unbelievable ebook In Conversation With, 7 of my favourite conversations from the show, to anyone who subscribes now to the Unbelievable newsletter. So a double reason to get yourself subscribed. Let's just go to a few more of your comments then to that Douglas Murray and Esther O'Reilly show, because not all have actually been positive to this, and I can understand why. Inevitably, it was a show in which both the speakers were very sympathetic to each other's point of view when it came to the issues of identity politics that were being discussed in Douglas's book. I really brought Esther more on for that latter part of the conversation, if you like, in which she would talk to him about her own reasons for believing. And that's probably the part that most people were actually responding to in those tweets. But others wanted to see more of a kind of substantive debate on the issues of identity politics, race, gender, trans, sexuality, and so on, that were brought up in the rest of the programme. Tiago on Facebook said, "While I find Douglas Murray interesting, this isn't the kind of show I've come to expect from Unbelievable. Having someone and a fan of his is probably more suited to a profile programme, not to a debate one, where I expect the reasonable, civil, and charitable defence of opposing positions. So I can't like this one," says Tiago. And this one, probably some of the most strident criticism from someone who I respect greatly. Derek has been a long-time listener of Unbelievable. And I'm going to read this email out in full, because I think this needs the right of reply. And we're going to try and do a proper show on these issues that you highlight in your email, Derek. But this is what Derek had to say. "This episode was a massive disappointment to me, for the same reason that the last show on this topic, Is Identity Politics the New Religion, was a disappointment. Namely, there was no dissenting voice. As you know, Mrs. O'Reilly is a tremendous fan of Jordan Peterson, who's also a critic of racial identity, so there was no reason to suppose that she'd have any disagreement with Douglas Murray. And this episode, rather than being a journalistic inquiry into Douglas Murray's book, was, for the reasons set forth below, was more like a free advertisement in favour of it. If you had chosen a dissenting voice to appear on the episode, they would have quickly pointed out a glaring fallacy in Douglas Murray's argument. In support of his many points against racial identity, he used the example of saying, 'I like all British people.' He correctly concludes that this cannot be literally true, because there are a great many British people who the person would probably not like. There's nothing intellectually profound in his statement. It's self-evidently obvious that within any kind of people group, there will always be distinctions between individuals. The conversation wasn't about the fallacy of making sweeping generalisations, however. It was on racial identity. So the proper question would have more rightly been, is a person who is not British and has no experience being British qualified to speak about the experience of being British? Did you not roll your eyes when Trump criticised the British struggle with Brexit? The issues raised by racial identity are not ameliorated by conveniently excising how certain people are treated on the basis of their immutable characteristics, and on the basis that each person in the people group has an individual set of personalities personality characteristics. The issue instead is in whether the person making the statement is qualified by their experience to make a statement about race. It's the qualifications of the speaker that give value to the statement. I would have liked to hear the conversation turn to whether Mr. Murray was qualified to criticize women for feeling a certain way towards something that uniquely arises from their experience as a woman, aside from abortion. I wonder how Esther would have responded then. If he was not qualified to criticise women on uniquely women's issues, then he's also not qualified to criticise commentators with brown skin who abstracted the forgiveness expressed in the Botham case and applied it to their own struggling experience with race. As a person who has suffered racism and who perceives a bit of bias in the professional realm, I can say that a person's experience in this world, as a person with any amount of melanin, most definitely touches upon their experience with Christian forgiveness. This is because, as a Christian, racism and bias must also be forgiven, like any other negative thing done to a person. It's self-evident that the more a Christian experiences racism and bias, the more they must exercise the Christian faculty of forgiveness. In fact, the racial issue wouldn't even arise if everyone were treated identically the same, regardless of the amount of melanin in their skin. Racial identity is imposed upon people of colour, not the other way around. As such, to concede that racism and bias exist in this world is to also concede that racial identity must also exist. The only way that Mr. Murray can conveniently do away with racial identity is to show that neither racism nor racial bias exist. I realise that I may be the only person writing in with this viewpoint, so here it is. It is shallow and racially insensitive to criticise commentators with brown skin who abstract the forgiveness expressed in the Botham case and applied it to their own struggles. I've never heard you, Mr. Briley, criticise anyone for struggling with a doubt arising from the suffering of others. How is the Botham extraction to one's own racial struggles any different? And you're talking about the Botham Jean case that they were debating there of forgiving the police officer, Amber Geiger. As a person of colour, I can tell you that the issue of Christian forgiveness in a racial context is an extra burden carried by people of colour that you, Mr. Briley, will never have to experience. People like Mr. Murray should thank God that they'll never need to experience this instead of criticising those who struggle with extending Christian forgiveness to people who have acted in racist and biased ways against them. I don't know if Esther O'Reilly is qualified to make any statement about the racial experiences of others. I do know, though, that the picture she selected to represent her was of a woman with peach skin. Overall, her opinion seemed to be well informed, but on the topic of the racial experience of others, her opinion strikes me as being a simplistic, unrefined and uninformed one, like Trump commenting on the British struggle with Brexit. I challenge both Douglas and Esther to find their nearest church, predominantly composed of people with brown skin, and set up a meeting in which the people with brown skin have an opportunity to explain their struggles with racism and bias. I wonder if Douglas or Esther will come away still thinking that the colour of one's skin is no more important than the colour of one's shoes. At least for Mr. Murray, he's under no obligation other than that imposed by his own conscience. Esther, on the other hand, brings herself under the authority of the New Testament. In this vein, Jesus himself said in John 13:35, that we should be known by the love we express. Christ did not say that we should be known for being racially insensitive or for giving offence. I do not agree and will never agree that any form of racial insensitivity can be reconciled with Christian love. Well, there you go. Thank you for your strident criticism, Derek. And we will try to give that subject a proper treatment. Obviously, it was only a relatively small part of the dialogue between Esther and Douglas on that programme itself. But we've never really done a proper discussion on race and Christianity on this show. And it's high time we did, probably. Thanks for writing in. Dottie said she was thrilled to see Douglas Murray as the guest this week. Thanks for having him on. Thanks for bringing him and Esther together for an amazing conversation. I've been curious and very amused by Douglas's calling himself a Christian atheist, and I appreciated a show which allows him to expand on that and his spiritual background a little further. And this one from Dylan on Facebook said, I really enjoyed the dialogue. I'm about a third of the way through The Madness of Crowds and find that Douglas Murray's diagnosis of our current Western society is challenging but accurate. Justin, you seem to have a recent trend of hosting intellectuals who are on a journey towards faith, or at least an acknowledgement that Christian values are necessary to form the foundations for the values our society cherishes. People like Tom Holland, Dave Rubin and Brett Weinstein. How curious. I love listening to this podcast alongside the intellectual dark web. Amazing how these Christians and atheists alike are seeking reasoned conversation on difficult issues in spite of the madness of the crowds. And Stephen Portlock says, another interesting show. I've taken some interest in Douglas's latest work ever since I first heard about it. And this was the most interesting discussion that I've heard so far. And that was because you widely chose to open out the discussion beyond the strict remit of Murray's book and to take on issues around the sanctity of life. To me, The Madness of Crowds was at once quite brilliant and just a little disappointing. While Murray was frequently spot on in his elaboration of the confusions and contradictions that make identity politics such a minefield, he failed to explore, to me, the more interesting questions of why the fault lines of morality have been situated on the areas of race, gender and sexuality. For all its qualities, 21st century Britain is still rife with social inequality and poverty, and it's often the poor, elderly and disabled who are scapegoated. Yet the forces of social justice can be callous at best where these demographics are concerned. Thank you very much for getting in touch, and well, that certainly brings us up to about time for this week's edition of the show. Lots of your feedback to that, and I always welcome more. Both the stuff that praises the output of the show and the stuff that's critical too. I want to hear both sides in these important discussions that we host here. And I'm fully aware that when we have done those identity politics issues, it's tended to focus more on Christians and non-Christians who kind of basically are sympathetic towards each other's points of view. I think we will make room in due course for those who maybe take different perspectives on those issues. For now, thank you very much for listening to today's programme. Great to have you with me. Don't forget to look out for the ticketing opening for Unbelievable, the conference in London this coming week. Saturday the 9th of May is the date to put in your diary to make sure you're there with N.T. Wright and other special guests, and excited to reveal who my mystery guest is that's going to be appearing alongside N.T. Wright at that conference. So look out for that this week at the unbelievable.live website. It'll be updated soon from our old conference material so that you can book in for our forthcoming London conference. For now, great to have you with me on today's show. And let me give you a little reminder of what to expect next week. Cosmic Skeptic, aka Alex O'Connor, well-known YouTube atheist, is going to be talking with young Oxford philosopher Max Baker Hitch, discussing the argument from reason. Does naturalism fundamentally undercut the concept of reason and rationality? I have argued that in a couple of discussions recently, last year. We're going to be doing a proper one this time with Cosmic Skeptic and Max. Coming to you via podcast and video on next week's show. For the moment, thanks for being with me, and see you next time. You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.